as I say, Stansfield Turner was criticizing the Israeli government for being too weak. He said that they should go on. The lesson of recent events in Lebanon is that one of Israelis' weaknesses when they paused or had a timeout was if you paused, you're weak, and that he suggested that the Israel shouldn't either go on in the next few days, he says, if they want to conquer West Beirut, that you don't take a stop. So they were getting a little coaching from Stansfield Turner, and I thought that was interesting. Also, it was used as a place for testing bombs. This was a test case. And if you think the people matter in native populations or in any major city or anywhere else, forget it. The main goal, and I may reiterate this every week until it gets loud and clear, the goal is a world war by 1985. And we're testing weapons, and we can't afford to not have Israel as our ally. We're going to use it as a launching base, and we're going to use Lebanon. So for all purposes, America decides who's the president of Lebanon. In return, we'll use your area, get rid of all the troublemakers now. They've outused themselves. They're linked to too many things. That part of the system is coming down. Send them to other countries and let them do their thing from there, and turn Lebanon into a good ally of America, and you'll have two nice fascist allies, Israel and Lebanon, side by side. We did love testing those weapons, and of course there were articles, I'm sure you saw them, vacuum bomb delegation, just private citizens. That was that vacuum bomb that hits at the building, and the air goes up, the thing completely collapses instead of hitting it from the top and falling down. Everybody in it dies. It sucks the air out of the building. It's designed to hit not the top of the building, but the bottom. It creates a vacuum. The air is forced up at a high velocity, and the building collapsed by itself, and that happened there. It was photographed, and there were American witnesses there to see it. Another typical article, Wall Street Journal. The Air Force says the U.S. jets and missiles outstripped the Soviets in Lebanon, and they're very proud of that. It proved all that they wanted it to do. Another New York Times article, performance of U.S. planes is praised. Not what in the heck are you doing to these poor people? They've been homeless for 32 years, but don't we have the most marvelous weapons? And another story from the Los Angeles Times and San Jose Mercury, Pentagon is studying the lessons of this year's war. Smart soldiers are better than smart bombs, and they go into the little Falklands, and particularly Lebanon, and they study it and study their equipment and see what can be done and get ready for the next. These are learning lessons. This is just play. This has nothing to do with preserving the planet or decency. There's nothing nice about this. They're going after the Soviet Union, and these are the stepping stones, and you're on them walking day by day. Now, the major columnists, I can't bring in all the articles to show you typical columns, but these syndicated columnists, Emmett Terrell, this is August the 10th, 1982, Lebanon's grim lesson, the PLO is America's enemy too. Another article, James Kilpatrick. Like any other cancerous lesions, the PLO must be cut out. These are the men that are in almost every newspaper around the country. This is August the 12th. Jack Anderson, August 14th. The truth in Beirut. And he goes into a long list of problems with the PLO and Arafat and how bad they are. But he begins by saying the U.S. leaders knew in advance that the Israelis intended to drive the Palestine liberation out of Lebanon. He printed that August the 14th, and Jimmy Carter had mentioned it last night. Now, when you get off the testing, it gets even more disgusting, because at the Bar Association, Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense, who has absolutely nothing to do with law, comes out to the Bay Area. I mean, a lawbreaker every single day. Disgusting people. Weinberger says, this is San Francisco Examiner, Weinberger, semicolon, U.S. and Israel should share the Beirut cleanup. Now, this is a president that promised he'd take the federal government off our backs, that the states would take care of us. We're supposed to put up $8 billion split it with Israel, $4 billion each maybe, to clean up Beirut. When I watched Good Morning America, they had pictures on NBC this morning of how to feed people out of garbage cans in the United States, some frozen crab that was seen, and wilted lettuce, and pinched peaches. And there's a kitchen, a fellow in Washington, D.C., cooks people, street people, everyday meals taken out of the garbage cans. And there's 30 to 40,000 in New York City alone living off the streets. And we're supposed to first pay out of our taxes this tremendous debt to make these weapons, okay? And then we're supposed to pay the Marines so much, like $1 million a day, to keep the Marines over there to get things going. Then we'll have to put up billions of dollars to clean it up. The profit for the weapons goes into the families, the multinationals who made the weapons, but the debt for paying for them is our debt. And Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, wants us to pay for this. Remember when he was working for Ronald Reagan in California, he was Mac the Knife. He was cutting all the money off of all our social benefits. Why doesn't he cut it off the war? But, of course, that's ridiculous. Now, one other question about a man that's kidnapped in Beirut, Mr. David Dodge. I never read that he was returned. He was kidnapped. He's from Princeton University. His family's at Princeton. His father, grandfather, founded the university, the Christian University, over in Beirut, and he's the acting president now. He was kidnapped June 20th by some people, David Dodge. He was seen. The kidnappers took him away by pro-Iranian Muslim Shiite sect. I haven't heard, maybe I skipped some newspaper, but he all of a sudden, after he's kidnapped, became a non-person, and I never heard about him. Now, there are four characters. If I divide each one of them up into 10 minutes and do more later, I want to talk about four Israeli citizens, people that were Israeli citizens. Okay, there's something going on in Israel that these commentators or the scholarly people that discuss the problems never relate to, and to unearth not just the sleazy characters, but major world operations and organizations would tell us more about Mr. Begin and Mr. Sharon and the leaders over there than a lot of other things that I can think of. There are four characters whose I've had articles about. One was sent to me from New York, from another World Watcher, long subscriber, wonderful article about a shadowy figure in Israel's Knesset. That's the parliament there. This came to me just last week. It was from the New York Times in 1979. His name is also Sharon, but I don't know that they're related or not related. The articles don't make the connection. Another article is about Eli Wolf, alias James Mahon Jr., Eli Haziv. The third is Eduardo Robbie. I'll give you the aliases, and maybe I'll tell you briefly about these four kinds of characters. Mr. Samuel Flatow Sharon is a Frenchman. He embezzled $60 million out of France. He went to Tel Aviv and immediately became an Israeli citizen. Instead of going to jail, he became a member of the parliament. He is now worth between $50 million and $400 million. He lives in a mansion in Tel Aviv and build shopping centers and wants to run the El Al airline. He fled Poland allegedly in the background. These people is interesting. As a child during World War II, was raised by a non-Jewish family in Paris. He's illiterate to this day, allegedly can't read or write Hebrew, doesn't know a thing about it. A member of the parliament and a close friend of the other Sharon, Samuel Flatow Sharon, began making his money in the black market in Paris after the war, collects Mondrian and Cezanne and various pictures. France wanted him back. Israel refused to return him because they kept one of the fellows that was responsible for the killing the Jewish athletes at the Munich Olympic Games who fled to France. And France kept him there and then let him leave there on his own recognizance. He just walked out. So they exchanged one person involved with the killings at the Olympic Games out of France for Mr. Sharon, who was worth parlayed $60 million he took out of France into $500 million right now living in Tel Aviv. Another Jew who wasn't a Jew at all. See, I question whether this Sharon, even in the Knesset, in the parliament, from Poland, could get from Poland to Paris during the war, or could be kept by non-Jewish family and no Hebrew, no Jewish training. I question, and I've always questioned, is Israel made and run by people set up by Nazi Germany, and I've said this before, who are running and are going to mend into the Middle East to give the appearance of friction, and there has been some friction, but is run by a handful of people of very interesting backgrounds, and I'm just mentioning a few tonight because, as I say, the battle of Israel into Lebanon, and Lebanon, Sharon with Gamaliel, is bigger than what you're going to see on Meet the Press or Face the Nation. Now, another character is Eli Wolf. His real name was Eli Haziv. He took the Jewish name. In the United States, he was James Mahon Jr. He was probably Irish. He was a Christian. He went to Vietnam. He was involved in two bloody battles in Vietnam. When he came back, he decided he would become an Israeli. So he changes his name to James Mahon, and he becomes Eli Haziv, which is Jewish enough. And then he goes about with his M16, killing Arabs wherever he can, which isn't good for the legitimate Jews or the authentic refugees who sought a homeland. And what we brought over to Israel or from all over the world are not those kind of people. They're run by a whole upper level of military hoodlums, and underneath are these poor, striving people trying to maintain all that they have after being displaced all over the world. Now, James Mahon was an informer for the FBI during the anti-war movement. He worked for the FBI, and his whole role in becoming a Jew was to shoot Arabs. So when you shoot Arabs, they shoot back, and little wars become big wars. Eli the Wolf, he was called. He was killed in a battle over there. Remember at the mosque just last year, it was Easter, that wasn't so long ago, all the killings where an American who wasn't Jewish went over there, decides that, or had no background in this kind of thing, and shoots down on the holiest day in the mosque various people, and then is carted away and had this nefarious existence in Israel that didn't really belong to any institution or kibbutz or organization. They come over from the American intelligence and secretive operations, and this one particular from Vietnam and the FBI, and go around shooting so that there's this constant tension there among the people who want to get along. It'd be, if you're living at home and want to get along in your neighborhood with your next-door neighbor, and you take in house guests who bring rifles and shoot at people, emptying the trash or bringing in the mail and starting altercations, how can you live in peace? And this is what has happened in Israel, and these are just two kinds of people. Now, another character, I have a long article on him, and I spent like 3 hours last night outlining, and I'll do some of it tonight, and as much as I have time, and I'll get back to it later, but I think you'll get the essence of these people. There's another fellow named Eduardo Rabi. He's supposed to be born in Lebanon and then moved to Israel when Israel became a country. Now, that's just what Israel needed in 1948. It was a new country. A lot of blood and suffering had gone into allowing these people finally to move here. And Eduardo Rabi had a few aliases. He also used the name Walter Arbib. He used the name Roberto Alessi. He was called Jack Bender. He was Elias Yassin. He had passports from Lebanon, from Israel, from Italy, from Paraguay. He was described in the New York Times, December 29, 1980, the international master of deceit. If you listen and want the bibliography of these broadcasts, write to me and I'll send you the dates of these articles if you want to look them up in the library. It's May Brussels, box 22511, Carmel 93922. Send a self-addressed stamped envelope and I'll give you the source of these people if you want to look at their biographies. Now, he had three different birthplaces, Iraq or Tripoli or Lebanon, and the main thing is that he ended up, as soon as Israel was a country, in 1948 he was in Israel. It was that same year that Otto Skorzeny brought all the top Nazis to Egypt to begin setting up the Bormann Brotherhood, the way that they would take care of Israel, erase Israel, and what existed with the Nazis. And, of course, up in Lebanon was the Falange family that is now working with Mr. Sharon. So Eduardo Rabi parlayed He went to Israel, and from there he went to Italy. He's been arrested in almost every country, but the intrigues and the arrests aren't as important as where he ended up. He was in Italy. He was with the jet set in every city, with the very wealthy people. He was in Milan and in and out of Milan. He was at Monte Carlo. He was in England. He was in Canada. He was in Los Angeles. Many times the law enforcement would be right after him. He would be swindling. But his biggest coup, besides being in Canada and Italy and Switzerland and France and Panama, he set up a complicated banking system in Panama. He went down to Paraguay, where he worked with Mr. Rodriguez, the head of the army, with dictator General Alfredo Stroessner. Now, Stroessner is a no-Nazi. It is the headquarters from Nazis all over the world, and his most famous citizen and cohort, who has a hospital down there and airplanes and an institution for medical experimentation, is Dr. Joseph Mengele from Auschwitz, who lives down in Paraguay and also is very close to dictator General Alfredo Stroessner. Well, the end of the line for this Jordanian, or whatever he was, this Eduardo Rabi, who's now in jail in New York City, he got too cute and swindled a woman that he met who in Panama, who had inherited a lot of money in Mexico, and she's a graduate of MIT. And she had investments, and he told her how to invest money. He had a chicken farm and one place in California, chicken farm, and he had another establishment in Colorado. And she was putting some of her money into his till, and finally she got suspicious of him and called an investment counselor, and he's in a jail in New York City. But whether he serves 4 years or 6 years there isn't the point. The point is that he went to Israel in 1948, and at the end of the line, before he shows up in New York City, he leaves $50 million with Joseph Mengele and Mr. Stroessner out of Swiss banks. Now, the Swiss banks were insured. They gave him $50 million. I talk about missing millions, and I have 26 inches of one filing cabinet of stories of this kind, such as the other Sharon in Israel with his $300 million, $50 to $400 million. And the Swiss banks are insured. Now, who pays the insurance? Who covers this? And is this a way to deliver to General Alfredo Stroessner? Because right now, I understand, and there's books on this, I can give you the reference, they've sterilized almost every male Indian in Paraguay. And that they're doing this in Uruguay, Brazil, Chile, and the South American countries in Peru. Dr. Mengele has been experimenting down there. He has been working there. He has not been quiet since World War II. He isn't young, but that is another person who began life, say, in Lebanon, went to Israel, took on a Jewish name or a Jewish identity, and then from then on, the end of the route is $50 million for Mengele through Swiss banks down there. All of these people, Israeli, supposed to be Israelis. One from Poland, Mr. Sharon going to France, taking $50, $60 million to Israel, parlaying it today into $400 million. Shaul Eisenberg is the fourth person I'll mention, and if I get time, I'll go into detail of some of these characters. Shaul Eisenberg was written up in Business Week, November 16th, 1981, a little less than a year ago. The Business Empire of a Global Mystery Man, the Complicated Empire. He was born in Germany, another one, born in Germany. Mr. Eisenberg lives right now in Israel. His home is Israel, Shaul Eisenberg. But he goes all over the globe. He went to Japan and lived there 20 years and married a Japanese woman. He opened up his Panama office called United Development Incorporated, set up in Panama in 1960. And again, this is why it's so important to know why Paul Marcinkus of the Vatican won't tell what the dummy fronts are in Panama, because he's been involved in the last 10, 20 years in stock swindles and multinational stories that I'll give to you next week that I'm putting off till next week. I want to talk about Shaul Eisenberg. Now, the Business Week describes him as starting his headquarters in Panama in 1960, born in Germany, goes to Japan, and then all of a sudden, he's building for the entire world. He's building railroads, he's building factories, he's building industrial manufacturing equipment places. This article says he has a consortium of manufacturers, builders, and banks to construct industrial facilities. He has Universal Seeds and Oil Company. He's building a plant in North Dakota, in Minneapolis with the I.S. Joseph Company. He builds in the Philippines, in Haiti, the aircraft trading and services for TWA. He picks up their old airplanes and carries them on to sell to other people. He builds atomic plants in Belgium for the people in Belgium. He builds in Romania, in West Germany, in India. He's described as a shadowy middleman involved with secrecy who simply gets a percentage and sets up these huge groups all over the world. Now, he has one group of 4,500 employees, mostly in Israel, but his financial affairs, according to Business Week, are maintained in at least one of his seven homes. One's in Israel, one's in Japan, one's in Britain. And he travels all over the world, and he wants to build in China. He's involved in every major country. He works for the government. He works for our CIA. He works for American business. He works for all the conservative countries, the Philippines, where there's a military dictatorship, for South Korea, where he got in on the bottom of that. He works for his home country, where he was born, in West Germany. And this is a long article you can get out. If your library doesn't have it, I can copy these for you. It's Business Week, November 16th, 1981. Now, this is his story. There are other considerable heroes in this element, but Mr. Eisenberg's story is a Jewish survivor of Nazi Germany, another one of these. Eisenberg was penniless. He was a refugee for only four decades ago. He was born in Munich in a Polish province in Austria. He fled from Germany and went to Switzerland, wandered through France and Luxembourg and Belgium, and just 14 days before the Germans invaded Holland, he escaped on a British freighter for Shanghai. I don't believe that happened that way at all. I don't think anything in these people's lives begins that way. I believe that there's more to the Mr. Sharon, who's the defense minister of Israel, who has Lebanon in his hand, as well as Ronald Reagan, even though Ronnie picked up the phone on him. I don't believe that Mr. Eduardo Rabi, delivering $50 million from the Swiss banks to Joseph Mengele's, and using the same bank as Mengele's and Mr. Stroessner, and traveling to every major city with every multinational millionaire entertaining him and wining and dining him. Shaul Eisenberg leaving Germany and wandering, a little Jewish child wandering around Europe at that time. I have enough books on Nazi Germany and on the era preceding it, say from World War I until World War II, from the invasion of Poland in 1939. These people not only recovered from their wandering, where allegedly, say, all the families were wiped out, like Mr. Begin, but Begin was in a Siberian camp. He's violently anti-Russian. But they deal with all the fascists, such as Begin will be happy to work with the new president of Lebanon. He selected him. I believe that what appeared as democracies, even in the United States, you had an election in 1960, John Kennedy won against Richard Nixon. That was the last election. Robert Kennedy was murdered, and you had a temporary president. We had Richard Nixon win. We had an interim there with Gerald Ford, appointed by Richard Nixon. Jimmy Carter from Atlanta, Georgia, is the headquarters of the huge combine of Lockheed, defense industry, the Coca-Cola network, but particularly the Lockheed. I have a whole book on Lockheed and their espionage relationships. He was an interim, and he was also hand-appointed by the Trilateral Commission and Ronald Reagan handpicked years ago. Israel is forming and has been for years a fascist nation, arming South Africa, arming Argentina, arming the far, far right for no reason. If they were not appreciated by their Arab neighbors, they've done nothing there really that's going to endear them. And the nucleus of the people living in Israel, if there were an attack on them by the Arab nations, they would be out. It would be the Jews sitting under the umbrella of the Israeli flag that would be demolished. Now, I have never, and I've mentioned this before, never been sympathetic with the Israeli cause. I never understood the people running it. I am not close to one single Zionist. I do not like the people that have been the government officials. I mean, I can be somewhat sympathetic to Mitterrand in France. I don't have to know him personally. I can be somewhat sympathetic, and I received a letter for Papandreou when he was exiled from Greece, and he's now the prime minister, the premier of Greece. I can understand what he's trying to do in giving full employment and get people to work and elevate their way of living without terrorism, without weapons around them, and even Khomeini without the Savak. He's pretty bad, but I can even be sympathetic. As strange as that sounds, I can be sympathetic to Khomeini because I don't think he was handpicked. But I can't be sympathetic to what's going on there. And as we read the newspaper and you look back at the last months, say from June to August, and I take 10 papers a day and I read it all, the whole war was a sham. Sure, they bombed the place out, decimated. It's only cement. It's only business to build it up. The main thing is that the people who ran it didn't get scratched. The dope will flow, the water was in their places, the electricity was on, and also this Sharon, one of the things that he wanted to do that when he moved to Israel was to open a casino outside of the harbor for gambling, and the Saudi Arabians were furious. There was a French ship they wanted, and Saudi Arabia was going to pull their money out of France if they let him have it. The swindler that took 50 to 60 million out of France, who's sitting over in Israel, who's in the parliament. He's in the Knesset. And these leaders do not speak for what was Jewish, whatever Jewish is in terms of philosophy or family styles or traditions or religion. It is a fascist government invading a group of people broken up by Henry Kissinger, a Nazi, the protege of Fritz Kramer. He broke up in the Civil War of Lebanon and made them ripe for a fascist takeover. Now you have a man who's proud to be a fascist. This was a staged show. There was the hostage show, the Falkland show. Next week, 2 weeks from now, or after we pass the $4 billion to build up Lebanon, we'll have the Central American show. And then the blood will get a little closer to us, and I just dread to see it because it's pointless, it's painful. The heads of the governments down there are getting more cruel. The death reports every day, if you're reading the papers, are horrendous. I'll do an update on the deaths if you want that for your dinner hour next week. But when the Lebanon show is over, the night show, it's in the hands of Haig, who set this up, and Kissinger, and Gamaliel, and Sharon. And they're all having a nice little party tonight. The PLO are splintered into different countries. They're split up. The bill is yet to be paid. The wine is flowing in part of the town, and it'll be as business as usual tomorrow, so don't worry about it. But watch these fascists move, because we pay the bills, they kill the people, and we sit like a bunch of dummies and tell them, well, go ahead, it's your game, okay? Well, that's what I think of the Middle East war. It was a three-month war. And that's the score. That's how I feel about some of these characters involved in it. This is Mae Brussel, and I'll be back with you next week on KZOO. You take care and read those letters. And if you want, I'll send you the bibliography of these broadcasts.
Hi. Have you ever wondered what happened to underground radio? Did it all turn into a more polished top 40 situation? Well,